Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will Bushman. We're continuing our series, our third part on the Gospel Revolution. Sam, where are we at?
So we're going to be jumping into reason number 7. So if I'm summarizing these, let me just give you the bullet points. Yeah. The first one is the Jewish exile. Like in 586 BC, Babylon conquers Jerusalem and all the Jews go scattering all over the place. And we talked about this in part 1. So if you haven't seen that, go back and watch that episode. The Jews went with all of the prophecies about the coming Messiah, and they went all over the world. And so all the world's kind of marinating, you know, in this prophecy. And so when the gospel happens, the spark hits the kerosene, and it explodes all over the place. Then they had pilgrimages that they had to make to Jerusalem. So from all over the world, they're coming back, and Jesus dies during Passover, and he's raised during the Passover celebration, and all of them go back home with that message, and we know that the gospel was spreading long before the gospels were written. Then you have the destruction of the temple. This is a big problem because that's where you came to meet God. That's where the temple was. That's where the priests were. That's where the sacrifices happened. But Jesus offers a solution that satisfies all that, being that he is the temple. And when you embrace him, the Holy Spirit comes to dwell in you and you become the temple. He is the once and for all time sacrifice, the Lamb of God. He is the great high priest who intercedes for you. So that turns people toward him. You have the conquests of Alexander, who conquers almost the whole known world back then, but spreads philosophy and Greek language, by which the Gospels are translated into Greek or written in Greek. The Old Testament is translated into Greek. So everybody can read the news of this coming Savior. And then the golden age of Greek philosophy has all of these brilliant people asking the big questions of life. Is there a possibility of justice? Is there any hope of a good regime, a king? All these questions, like how did we get here? And when the gospel comes, it answers all of those questions so perfectly that in the early centuries of the church, they were like, oh my goodness, the philosophers are to the Greeks what the Old Testament was to the Hebrews. It just set up so perfectly the gospel to come. And so then in part 2, we talked about the tyrants, right? You had Caesar Augustus who comes, and all of Rome is like, oh my goodness, here's this divine figure who's coming to bring a kingdom that's going to put an end to all wars, and it's glorious and wonderful, and morality and everything else is never going to be better. But then the heirs to the throne, beyond Caesar Augustus, who's no saint himself, all of the Julio-Claudian dynasty emperors, Tiberius and Caligula and Claudius and Nero, are utterly disgusting and self-absorbed and cruel and immoral to the most extreme. And so the gospel comes and says, hey, there's a different kingdom and there's a different kind of king, one that's not abusive, but one who comes to suffer for you, not one who demands everything from you and taxes so that he can live the privileged life, but one who leaves heaven and comes and experiences homelessness and suffering to pour himself out for you so that you can become a citizen of his kingdom where there's an everlasting inheritance, right? And so these options are presented by the negative traits of the emperors. It made so many people in the Roman world go, this kingdom is gross. I prefer a far better kingdom and to live in light of the hope of that. And so the last episode, we talked about how gross the emperors were. It's a rough episode to walk through. So today, what we're going to do is turn a little bit and say, okay, they did a lot of good stuff too. The Roman world that they helped to bring about actually had some things that were positive that benefited the gospel and helped the gospel also to explode for good reasons, not just their negative example by contrast.
And that's the whole point of why we've kind of maximized this series to say, okay, no, God chose to send Jesus at the appointed time, and this is that time. So why did it all happen? And the Roman system was one of those reasons.
100%. So yeah, like this one of the questions where people, why didn't God send Jesus way earlier?
Yeah.
Why didn't he send him today? You know, we have technology. There's all these questions. But when you look at the conditions of first century when Jesus came into the world, everything is so perfectly positioned. All the dominoes are laid out. And Galatians tells us when the time had fully come. And that's that expression is like almost like an hourglass. Like the moment has come, boom, it's here. And God says, now's the moment. Go, this is the perfect moment. And that's exactly what you find. I mean, the world's just set up for the gospel to spread like wildfire.
Okay, so what's the first one we're thinking about today?
So today, one of the good things that came about by Caesar Augustus is when he comes about and he comes to power in 27 BC, Rome has pretty much been in perpetual war prior to this. You had the first triumvirate, which was civil war, a lot of bloodshed. Then you had the second triumvirate where Caesar Augustus is contending for authority up against Mark Antony and a guy named Marcus Lepidus. And so he finally consolidates all power to himself, eliminates these other rivals. All of the jockeying of all the different territories, like who should we align with? And there's war everywhere, goes away. And you enter into something called the Pax Romana, which is a Latin expression that means Roman peace. And so it's new. The world had been in such upheaval and convulsions for so long that when you get the Pax Romana, everything's at peace. And that's ideal for the gospel to begin exporting all over the Roman Empire.
So how did this Pax Romana help the gospel and Christians and the spread of it all?
So what you had before, if you've got warring factions and different tribes everywhere, you can't do commerce, right? Mm. That's one thing you can't do, because if I've got a good that I want to sell to that territory way over there,
can't do it.
I'm not going to go beyond the border if those people hate my people, because then it's... So what happens when Caesar Augustus puts an end to all the major factions and fighting is it opened up the globe to commerce, and so trade routes started. You could, and by the way, he put an end to piracy, because before that, pirates were allowed in certain sections of the world to target other people coming from other sections of the world because they didn't get along.
Yeah.
But under Caesar Augustus, all piracy stopped. So you could get in a boat and travel all over the Mediterranean with a much reduced fear that you were going to be targeted. You could go between territories because these trade routes had been really made healthy to where you had enormous amounts of trade, lots of people caravanning all over the world. And guess what? Just like you could go sell your wares to any region of the world, guess what else you could do? You could take
the gospel,
and you could get in a boat like Paul did and go all over the world with safety. You could travel the roads and go in safety, and you could make it to other places. The History Channel sums it up. I'm just going to read what they say. Political stability encouraged money lending and allowed long-distance trade to boom. Sea commerce thrived as the Roman navy under Augustus largely cleared the Mediterranean of pirates. Romans purchased luxurious silks and gems from the Far East, so these long-distance trade routes are going on, and found markets for their glass and rugs as far away as India and China. And we know, guess where else the apostles went? It wasn't just in the Roman Empire. Yeah. They were going as far as India, you know, like the church Mar Thoma that's in India still to this day was founded by the Apostle Thomas. So we know that they went to the East as well as the West. And all of this was made possible by the Pax Romana.
And you see how necessary it is because, as we've talked about before, this is quite the mission that Jesus leaves them, to spread the gospel to all nations, to all corners of the globe. And this would have been a huge obstacle that got wiped out for them. So now that they can travel, it just makes life a lot easier in that regard.
Yeah, world travelers become the norm, where before this, it would have been much more difficult. So there's a Stoic philosopher whose name is Epictetus, and he says this: Caesar seems to provide us with profound peace. There are no wars nor battles anymore, no great bands of robbers or pirates. We are able to travel by land at every season and to sail from sunrise to sunset. So traveling just becomes easy. And when you're spreading the gospel all over the world, pretty self-evident, the Pax Romana is a big help.
Okay, so that's number 7. What's number 8?
All right, so number 8 kind of piggybacks on the same thing. And it's that there's a unified political system, because prior to this, if you had all the different factions that were warring, well, now they're not only warring, but now they've got one governing force that's over all of them, okay? And so if you went into the first century, the Roman Empire was composed of more than 2 million square miles.
Wow.
Huge. I mean, all the shoreline of the Mediterranean was under Roman control. 20% of the global population lived inside of the Roman Empire. And so what this unified political system did is it made everything easier for travelers, merchants. So like imagine today, if you were the Apostle Paul, for instance,
okay,
and you went from your town of Jerusalem, where you start, you know, you're sent out by the apostles. Everywhere he goes, imagine if you had to show up and ask permission to enter the land. Hmm. You had to get special visas, like if you live today. But think about the places he went. He'd have to check in with Syria, Lebanon, Cyprus, Turkey, Italy, Greece, Bulgaria, Macedonia, Malta, Israel, and a number of other independent nations. If he was doing that today, you'd have to stop and you'd have to have your passport stamped and, oh, you're one of those. Well, you're not allowed here. Yeah. Like, and so that didn't exist. It was one unified political system. And so as a Roman citizen, the Apostle Paul could travel through each new territory with no problem because it was one unified Roman world. And the other part of this is they had port cities, right? And Paul, this is where he would always establish churches, right? So when you think of the major cities that he establishes churches, you think Corinth, you think Ephesus. Why is that so easy? He can go there, plant a church, and what's enabled, it's not just that the gospel sharers are going all over the world. Well, now all of the trade is going all over the world. And so when Paul, it's not accidental that he's like, hey, Corinth, major port city, trade going all over the world, tremendously wealthy city. Sailors are coming from here and here and there and all over the place. Let's establish a gospel sharing church there, because guess what? When those people come into town and they get converted, they go back home there and there and there and there. And the same with Ephesus, another port city. And so in this unified political system and the Pax Romana, all of these, you know, you're just seeing strangers and foreigners from all over the place that are traveling. And that, it's like, you know, if you throw seed into the wind and the winds are blowing and it goes far and wide, you're going to have seeds germinating and producing flowers all over the place. That's kind of what's going on with this. The seed of the gospel is just scattering everywhere and it's set up for it.
Yeah, and that really made not just the ease of spreading the gospel, but the speed of it. Because pretty quickly, you know, decades later, you see the gospel has gone to the far ends, and it's because of reasons like this.
Mm-hmm. That's 100% true. So there's a political principle that says when you have a novel idea, something that's new, it almost always starts in the major cities.
Okay.
Anytime you have some new idea, something that's changing from the way it's been, it always starts in the big cities and then begins to spread out. So if you were to look, for example, at a map of where conservative politics happen and where liberal politics happen, and in modern terms, we'd say Democrat versus Republican.
Okay.
The Democratic districts are almost always on shorelines or along rivers. Why is that? Because the conservatives that want to conserve the way things have been like the way things are, but people that are on the coastlines or along rivers that are exposed to new ideas begin to go, oh, you know what? The way that it's always been, I kind of like this new idea. And so that's always where you find the new ideas. We want to try this. We want to abandon what's always been to go with this new idea. Well, the same was true with Christianity. It spread first and foremost in all the cities. Today, where do you find Christianity predominantly? It's the Bible Belt. It's out in the rural areas. The Christians are out in the sticks. But in the cities, they're all abandoned. That's the reputation anyway, that the cities are abandoning. And in the early church, that was not the case. The church dominated the major cities, dominated Rome, dominated Ephesus, dominated Corinth. And the word pagan, do you know where that actually stems from?
No.
It comes from a Latin word, paganus, and it means rural.
Huh.
Because the people who still worshiped the pagan gods weren't with it. Christianity had come in and just absolutely blew up in all of these cities. And the rural folks were the last ones to convert, which, by the way, is instructive for the modern day churches. If you want to have a seat of influence, we need to win the cities. We need to get a seat at the table where our voice, where we present intellectually why Christianity is superior over all other worldviews and religions, and take root in the city, because what the cities believe is ultimately where the rural areas tend to follow later on. And that's exactly what happened with Christianity.
All right, we got seven, we got eight. Now what's number nine?
Number nine, and it fits right into this same theme. But the Romans were known for being expert builders of roads, like the world had not seen any time before this. And in fact, during the Roman Empire, the road systems were better throughout the territory of the Roman Empire than they would be as they fell into disrepair until centuries and centuries later. Huh. So like this was the height of the road system. And so just to give some context, like it's estimated that the Roman road network was more than 250,000 miles long.
Wow.
Now that's all the roads. That's dirt roads, that's okay. Paved roads, stone roads. But the paved roads, where they would dig trenches and they would dump massive boulders and then smaller rocks and then smaller rocks and then cap that with dirt and then put pavers over them to where they stand the test of time. You can still go over into areas of the Roman Empire and you can still see very famous roadways that are still there and stone roads. But just to give context, okay, 50,000 miles of paved roads. America did something pretty amazing in the 1950s when one of our presidents, Dwight D. Eisenhower, launched the interstate program where he decided, I'm going to build interstate system all over the country. And a lot of our interstates that we enjoy today came out of Eisenhower and it was considered, oh my goodness, this is a monumental feat like of engineering. And this is amazing what it did for American commerce and everything else. It was 46,000 miles in total.
Oh, less than.
So under Rome with these carrying bricks and rocks and everything else, they built 50,000 miles of paved roads. Eisenhower built 46. So when you get a scale of these roads, and if you look at them on a map, where they went and what they would look like if they were lit up at night, you literally see just roads going everywhere. Well, guess who used the roads? Why did the Romans want the roads?
Their army.
Their army. You could get to respond to a trouble situation really quick when you're not having to break out machetes and cut through things and everything else. Like, no, you get on a road and your chariots and everything else, and you're there in a hurry. But guess who else got to use those roads?
Christians.
Christians, businessmen, merchants, everything. Travel became so, so fast. And so the Christians would use these roads as well. Have you ever heard the expression, all roads lead to Rome?
Yeah.
It's where this comes from. So if you look at the map, you'll see that all of the roads, it's just super dense as it gets to Rome, and all those roads, every which road you stepped on could ultimately get you to Rome. Which for the apostles, when you read the apostle Paul, you get a very clear impression that Rome is the great gem that he wants. He wants the gospel to take hold of Rome. And he'll ultimately go to Rome and he'll be in house arrest in Rome and he will brag about how Rome is really being impacted by the gospel. And why is that so amazing? Because from Rome, roads go out to every single part of the Roman Empire. And so the Caesars, the emperors who made this possible, those wicked guys, you know, the unified political system benefited the gospel. The Pax Romana benefited the gospel. These roads benefited the gospel. And so we can give thanks for some of their work, you know, beyond just the awful things that they did that made Jesus look way better.
All right, so that's number nine. And we're here on the last one of the episode today. What's number 10?
Number 10 is an interesting one. Like if I were to ask you what professions, like what job of people is the most often convert of Jesus? Do you have one that jumps to mind?
No, I just think of the disciples and fishermen. But that's, fishermen, that's
so
it.
Fishermen's up there. But you find, okay, tax collectors. So you get Matthew as a tax collector. Zacchaeus was a tax collector. Prostitutes, they're in there. Like, that's another profession. But there's one that we look past that's really, I think, the Bible, when it comes to us and it presents us with it, there's a lot of converts of this particular profession, and that is Roman soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Rome had legions of armies that were dispatched all over the place, and they were constantly traveling around, right? And so if you converted a soldier, you converted somebody whose job was to march around and to take this gospel and what he believed to this city and this city and this city, and they were seen as having authority. And that's where, like, if you go into the Bible, how many times do you come across a Roman centurion that's converted to Christ. It's pretty often. Like, when you start looking at it, you're like, man, there's a lot of them. Well, what's a centurion? Why are they called a centurion?
The amount of soldiers they...
The amount of soldiers. What's a century? How many years?
100.
100. Well, they actually presided over more than 100, but initially they were supposed to be 100, so they were called centurions. And it would be like, you know, a sergeant, a general, a lieutenant had this number of troops under them. So these are people of authority. And when you start going through the Bible, you find lots of these guys. Okay, so what is a centurion? Polybius, who's an ancient guy, writes about the qualifications for what a centurion had to be. And listen to what he says. In choosing their centurions, the Romans look not at men who will open the battle and launch attacks, but those who will stand their ground even when worsted or hard-pressed and will die in defense of their post. So it's not the crazy athletic guy who's like, oh, I'm going to go get you, but it's the guy that says, I will die for this cause. I have courage. I've got conviction. I'm immovable. That's the kind of people that were centurions, okay? So get that impression into your head. Why would God want people like that on his team?
Because they're going to be hard-pressed as they try to spread the gospel.
Yeah, you're not moving me.
Yeah,
I'll die for this. The same conviction that leads them to be attractive candidates to become centurions for the Roman army, the Lord looks at and says, okay, but what if I could turn you? What if I could turn your heart to the gospel and you had that same willingness to die for your convictions, this immovable, I will not be shaken from my post conviction? And then let's go through the New Testament and we see the number of centurions that are involved, like Luke chapter 7, where you have a Roman centurion who had actually helped to build the synagogue in Capernaum, who has a servant who is sick. And he comes to Jesus and he says, what? I want you to heal my servant. And Jesus says, okay, I'll be right there. And what does the centurion do? He says, look, I'm a man under authority. Yeah. I know who you are. And I know that all of existence is under your authority, essentially. So I just need you to say the word, command, and my servant will be healed. And it happens. And presumably, the centurion servant comes to faith. And guess what? He's got so much influence over his soldiers that are traveling all around. I would suspect that a number of them come along too, right?
Yeah.
So we see that centurion come to faith. Then you fast forward to the end of the Gospels when Jesus is on the cross and he's endured unbelievable suffering. He's been whipped. He's had the crown of thorns. He's been beaten, all of that stuff. And the soldiers are all around the cross and they're mocking him. And then the land goes dark. And then the earthquake comes. And then this guy who's being crucified, who's suffering for a lack of oxygen, cries out in a loud voice to his father. And all of these supernatural things are going on at the same time. And what does that centurion cry out?
That's God.
Surely this man was the Son of God. And guess who hears it?
Yeah.
Everybody else under his authority. And you got to wonder, like, what happened to that guy? I wonder who he influenced. At the next chapter, after the resurrection, the guards that were positioned at the tomb, they got firsthand witness of crazy things for the resurrection. They're witnesses. Then you jump into the book of Acts and you get a guy named Cornelius, who's a centurion. And listen to what it says. He was a centurion in what was known as the Italian regiment, which means he's stationed near the center of influence. This is a powerful guy that has probably come from the Roman precinct, and he is a centurion in the Italian regiment. And here Peter comes to him, and it's this great conversation that this gospel, this faith, is not just meant for the Jews. It is meant for the Gentiles. It is meant for precisely foreigners like yourself. And Cornelius comes to faith, and you got to wonder what kind of influence he has. Then Paul, who's in prison, Acts chapter 27, he and other prisoners are handed over to who? A centurion again, named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. Why does it tell us this? So here you have the centurion that is put on a post who is seen as so valuable to the Roman world that he's actually in charge of the imperial regiment, the regiment that's closest to the heart of the empire. And he is going to see the power of the gospel at work in Paul's life. And he actually intervenes to save Paul's life at one point. So you have all these centurions, all these Roman soldiers that are coming to faith, and you just got to think, they're traveling, next mission, next city, the centurion bringing everybody underneath them, and they're just a natural, built-in, wonderful evangelistic arm, and God is using the strength and might of the Roman Empire, and he's infiltrating it, and it's like a judo move where you use somebody's weight, they're coming against you, and you use their momentum against them. The Lord is using the Roman army. Think about how wild this would have been. Because what was the Messiah in first century? Everybody expected the Messiah to do what?
Destroy Rome.
You better. You're going to destroy Rome. You're going to overthrow them. We're going to raise up an army and we're going to go conquer their army. And God does it, but not the way everyone expected. He begins conquering centurions, which is pretty awesome. He changes their heart. He doesn't go after them with a sword. And they begin to change. And I love this in Philippians when Paul, who is writing from jail, house arrest, he's in Rome, wondering what his fate is going to be. Listen to what he says in Philippians chapter 1. So he's writing to the city of Philippi, which is, by the way, known for being a base for the Roman military. The city of Philippi is filled with Roman soldiers. And he writes to them and says, I want you to know, brothers, this is chapter 1, verse 12 and 13, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me, I'm in chains, like I'm imprisoned right now. What has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard. What has happened to me is now impacting all of the imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Jump to the chapter 4 at the end of the book. And listen to what he says when he's offering his final greetings. He says, I want you to greet every saint in Christ Jesus, because you're lots of military people in Philippi, right?
Mm-hmm.
The brothers who are with me greet you. All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. So think how monumental that is, that Paul, who's writing to the Philippians before the Gospels are penned, in all likelihood, is saying Caesar's household, the imperial guard, they're in the tank. Yeah, they are sympathetic to the gospel, like my imprisonment is winning them. And so the Lord is not just calling and telling us centurion after centurion after centurion's falling, but Paul is letting us know that these Roman soldiers who see how gross and selfish the emperors are, when presented with King Jesus, now they're ready to give their lives. Now they're loyal. So tell everybody back in Philippi, all those soldiers, the ones in Rome, are with us too. And God uses this mighty expansive empire with an army that stretches over 2 million square acres and or miles and controls all that stuff. That army that's in charge of all that, they're coming. And so they are going to be used by God. The very army that everybody expected the Messiah to destroy is being co-opted to advance the gospel and the kingdom of Christ, which is amazing.
Yeah, and what a lesson from Paul that when Jesus said, I want everyone to hear of the gospel, it means even the enemies that have you bound in chains. It means even the guards that are on your left and your right, they're forcing you to stay there. Paul said, I don't hate them. Actually, I'm going to give them what they really do need, and that's the gospel of Jesus Christ.
That's right. And then they become friends. Then they become brothers. Then they become citizens of a far better kingdom. And so the emperors that had built this grand vision of Rome and all of these wonderful things because they thought that their earthly kingdom would be the glory of all men, all of that has been exploited and co-opted by the Lord to advance a far better kingdom. It's pretty wonderful.
It's amazing.
All right, and so just because I want to give, you know, just a quick clarification that we don't know what happens with these centurions.
Yeah.
It's left to our imagination. But the fact that the gospel, Jesus, his apostles, attract and win centurions, the most hated of all people in Israel, it invites us to imagine, what did they do? Where did they go? And again, it's totally the imagination. But I think it's an educated guess that if Paul's writing to the Philippians, talking about how Caesar's household and all of those in the imperial regiment are now sympathetic to the gospel, that we're allowed to imagine that the Roman army is co-opted to bring the gospel to the ends of the earth.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. God's sovereignty, even as we looked at in this episode of the gospel revolution, coming from things like the Pax Romana, the unified political system, the system of roads, and just like you just said, the deployed soldiers. It's truly amazing that God has all this under control. Mm-hmm. And he's doing it so his word, his gospel, the good news that his son was crucified for sinners like us, and that message needs to spread.
So on part four of the gospel revolution, we're going to be addressing how the gospel was so perfectly positioned to reach the marginalized groups in the Roman Empire that were so starved for hope that when the gospel came, it spread like wildfire through those particular communities. And thank you for watching. Join us next time as we go under the hood of another story in the Bible.
And as always, don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe.